night. Maybe some of you were there. And now, please welcome to the stage two groovy dudes, Dusty Baker and Greg Dalton.
Here with this. You'd wear one.
I always thought the Commonwealth Club, you had to dress up. I would love to not dress up, trust me.
We're not as square as you think sometimes. Well, it's an honor to be here and talk about some great stories today. In 1967, Dusty Baker's mom gave him a birthday present that would change his life and would be the envy of every teenager who grew up in the 70s, 80s, 90s, or even today. He got two golden tickets to the legendary Monterey Pop Festival featuring Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jefferson Airplane, Otis Redding, and The Who. The concert is famous for the collection of talent on stage and iconic moments such as Jimi Hendrix lighting his guitar on fire, The Who smashing their instruments, and for creating a model for Woodstock 2 years later. I'm Greg Dalton, and over the next hour, I'll revisit the fragrant and frolicking 60s with former professional baseball player and manager Dusty Baker. We'll talk about his love of music, the tunes and people who shaped his life, and his career in the big league. We also will hear his views on race relations in American sports and culture. This program from the Commonwealth Club of California is part of our Good Lit series and is underwritten by the Bernard Orscher Foundation. Please welcome Dusty Baker to the Commonwealth Club. Dusty, welcome. So how cool is your mom? I'm thinking, like, I'm just trying to understand. You're 18, yeah. It's the 60s, and your mom lays on two tickets to go to Monterey.
Well, I don't know if I could do that to my son, take it. You know, I mean, my mom was real cool. My dad was really cool, too, but my mom, you know, she was progressive. You know, she went back to school at a later age, and, you know, she was in and around, you know, young people all the time. And so my mom was a black studies teacher at Sacramento City College. And at the time, my mom and dad had just gotten divorced. And so I was at a crossroads on what to do. I didn't know whether to play football or basketball in college. I had no scholarship offers in baseball. I had quite a few in other sports. I didn't know which school to go to. I didn't know which sport to play. I was at a crossroads. And my mom gave us two tickets on my 18th birthday to the Monterey Pop Festival, which I didn't really know what it was about or have any idea. And she gave us, gave me $20. And I went and filled the car full of gas, filled the Rambler station wagon up full of gas. And my buddy and I, Gary Woodrell, headed off, and we got a flat tire, like on the freeway in Richmond right here. You know, on the way down to Monterey, and we slept in the car. The Rambler had the greatest seats in the world because they Rambler station wagon, all the seats would fold all the way down. So we slept in the car, and we bathed on the beach, and it was a happening, really.
And music was a big thing in your life. So tell us about the music. You obviously wrote this book about the music, yeah. And you were into music. Your dad was into raised you on the blues.
Yeah.
So tell us about some of the acts that you saw there in Monterey. Ooh,
I saw almost everybody. But see, it started at the house where my mom loved Roberta Flack. She loved Mahalia Jackson. My dad loved Miles Davis and Coltrane, which I really didn't understand at the time, you know, because my dad was like super straight. And, you know, naturally, him and my mom loved Ray Charles. And every day in the morning, let me go back. My dad loved B.B. King and Muddy Waters. He really loved Mud. And so every morning, my mom, the alarm clock was playing Lou Rawls on Tobacco Road. and I hated that song because that meant, I mean, imagine that when you're a youngster hearing that song every morning. You know, that meant it was time to get up. And so, you know, my mom made me take piano when I was a kid. And she wanted me to, I guess she wanted me to be like Liberace or somebody, but I wanted to be like Little Richard. And then when I saw, I really wanted to play the guitar. But she said that the piano was the basis to all music. And if I see the mothers shaking their heads out there. And so I had to play these recitals in front of the church. And I had to play like a Blue Danube followed by a Hungarian Rhapsody. And then I'd do like this. And so my mom, when I saw Jerry Lee Lewis on the Ed Sullivan Show playing the Great Balls of Fire, and I was like, dang, that's how I want to play. And so my mom came in one day, and I had my feet on top of the piano, like, you know, like Jerry Lee Lewis. And she says, have you lost your mind? Get your feet off of that piano. And so anyway, music was something that was always, you know, in our house. And, you know, my dad and mom would have parties, and, you know, they would jitterbug, and I'd watch them dance, and so, you know, it was fun in our household. And music is what inspired, you know, us daily. And, you know, my mom really didn't like James Brown. I love James Brown because my mom said that, you know, he didn't sing. He didn't do nothing but holler. But I like the beat, you know what I mean? So you just couldn't stand still. I still can't stand still when I hear music.
And you also write that you listen to the lyrics. Some people listen to the guitar, the beat, et cetera, that you've always been tuned in to the lyrics.
Right. I mean, I can hear everything, kind of. Sometimes I wish I didn't hear everything, which in my job sometimes, I was like, man, I wish I didn't hear that. But I can hear across the room. I can hear three or four things. Just like before, you know, I knew that song. That was one of my favorite songs. If you're going to San Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair. And so I knew the lyrics, and the lyrics is what really motivated me and inspired me a lot of the times. Not only, you know, I hear the beat, I hear the guitar, you know, I hear, especially, you know, I hear the bass guitar, probably more than anything, and the African sounds of the bass, you know, the bass drum, the bass guitar, the bass everything. And so that's how I was taught to dance. You know, you dance to the bass. Now the people that can't dance, they dance to the lead guitar. That's why they end up going 100 miles an hour.
Now, the Monterey Pop Festival is almost 50 years ago, yeah. And a lot of people who were there. Is anyone in the audience who was actually in Monterey? Where they got about two people who were in Monterey for that legendary concert in 67?
You guys sure look different now.
And really, I mean, how many people really remember it? So, right. You know, did you look at the movies? You know, D.A. Pennebaker made a famous film about the movie. What did you do to kind of go back to that time to write the book?
Well, actually, Steve, you know, it wasn't my idea to write a book because I have about 100 authors want me to write a book. And, you know, I don't like telling on myself sometimes. And if you write a book, you got to tell the truth. And so Steve Kettman, you know, he asked me to write this book. And he had heard me talk about Jimi Hendrix and some of my experiences in music, where like we used to come to San Francisco like almost every weekend. Or we'd go to Davis, the Freeborn Hall, and they always had concerts there. We saw Steve Miller Blues Band. We saw Bob Marley there later. Like we came over here, we'd hang out in Winterland, Fillmore. You know, in Winterland we saw like Spirit and Ike and Tina Turner Review together, and just like when Santa Clara, when they were trying to recruit me, we saw Stan Getz and the Jefferson Airplane. And I mean, that's like it was like America was trying to, you know, commingle between the mellow and the rock and the black and the white. We're at that time, you know, we're in a very tumultuous time in our country, you know, unrest about everything. You know, there was. You know, anti-Vietnam, there was, you know, race riots. My mom and dad didn't mind me coming to San Francisco, as long as my dad didn't like me going to Berkeley. and you know, that's the first place I went to, you know. You know, because my dad didn't like me. You know, he didn't want me being influenced by the Panthers. He didn't want me being influenced by Joan Baez. And he didn't really want me being influenced by, Timothy Leary, whom I've seen already at that time. And so, you know, it well-rounded me into, you know, being the person I am, because naturally, being an African-American, I was into the Motown sound and all the things that I listened to at the house. But when we moved to Sacramento, we were the only black family in the community in Carmichael. So kind of, and it's just me and my brother at the high school. So, you know, my friends at that time, all the new dudes that I met, you know, were into the more of the rock sound. And I remember in eighth grade in Riverside, I don't know why these girls were all screaming and hollering over the Beatles. And then later on, then I got into them as well, and the Doors and the, you know, the Mamas and the Papas and, you know, Canned Heat and Creedence Clearwater, and just, you know, it rounded out my music. But Jimmy took it to like another level. I mean, that was something that frightened me because I didn't know where he was coming from. But I was kind of willing to follow him, but not jump over the edge. You know what I'm saying?
But you did do something with him.
Right. Well, yeah, I did.
So you went to Monterey Pop in 67, yeah. And you were a four-sport athlete, you know, aiming high. Yeah. And
I wanted to be a pro.
You wanted to be a pro, and so you did not smoke pot, did not do anything, and you were a part of it, but didn't.
All my buddies did. I mean, all of them, and we had a pack. Me and my best friend, we had a pack that we wouldn't smoke, like everybody else was smoking, and then we end up breaking our pact because I smoked with somebody else, and he smoked with somebody else, and then we end up, hey man, I got a confession to make, and then. And then he goes, well, me too. And I was like, oh, Lord. So, and then one day we were in San Francisco. I mean, I was 19 then. And we were in San Francisco. We rented a place on Broadway next to Carol Doda's over there. And there were six of us. And, you know, we flipped for the box spring. Three guys slept on the box spring. Three guys slept on the mattress. And so we came out and, you know, try to peek into Carol Doda's.
That's a strip club in San Francisco.
They know what it is. Yeah. And so, and you couldn't peek in because they had a partition there which you couldn't try to peek in, couldn't see anything. And so we walked around the corner and there was Jimi Hendrix standing on the corner. And so I said, man, I said, man. And so my buddy's like, hey, man, go talk to him. I said, you go talk to him. And then my buddy said, hey, man, offer him a joint. And I said, you know, that'll open the conversation. So I offered him a joint, and then they all came over. So
if that happened today, people would be taking a selfie of them smoking to joint with Jimi Hendrix, right?
Yeah, or you'd have somebody filming it or something, that TMZ or something, you know? So
it was decision time for you, a four-sport athlete. You were thinking about going to Santa Clara where Coach Carroll, you actually had signed a letter of intent to Coach Carroll. So tell us about that next stage of your life.
Well, the next stage, my parents had gotten divorced. And like I said, I didn't know what to do. I mean, there's two or three crossroads in your life, and that was one of them. That was one of my first ones. And so I got drafted by the Atlanta Braves, and I prayed the night before that whatever happens, don't send me to the Atlanta Braves because I didn't want to go to the South. And the next day I woke up, they says, hey, congratulations, you're a proud member of the Atlanta Braves. And I'm like, Lord, you didn't hear me. And so the Braves are playing in LA against the Dodgers. And, you know, my hero was Tommy Davis, and he wore number 12, and I ended up wearing number 12 and playing his position, which I was probably the most fortunate kid in the whole world when you end up, you know, being, you know, taking your hero's place later on. And so I met Hank Aaron, and Hank met my mom, and Hank Aaron promised my mom he'd take care of me as if I was his own son if I signed. And I didn't know what to do. I said, what do I do, Mr. Aaron? He says, you know, if you have enough confidence in yourself to make it to the big leagues by the time your graduating class would have graduated from college, then you go ahead and sign. If not, then you go to school. But if you do sign, then you go to school anyway. And so that's what I did. And then they sent me from there. I went from there to Little Rock, Arkansas, to play my first game. And boy, that was 67. I've never seen the swamps. And I remember sitting on the bus and looking out, you know, and seeing trees with no leaves on them growing out of the water. I was like, man, this ain't too cool. So so my first game, I dropped the first game, and they marched these people in on the right field side where I was. And there were about probably 50 of them. And they marched them in, and I was looking at them, and, you know, I didn't think anything of it. And I dropped the first fly ball hit to me, and they start calling me all these names, man, like I had never heard before. And I start crying, and I wanted to come home, and I talked to Cito Gaston, who was my teammate then, and he told me, hey, man, I'll take care of you. I always had somebody always take care of me because I was always the youngest on every team I was on. And so I found out the next day that all the people that were calling me names were people from the mental institution next door that come to the game every Thursday, but didn't nobody tell me. And so then I came back home to go back to school because Vietnam was hot. So you had to carry 15 units per semester or else you were drafted. And so I came back home to go to school, and I got served to go to court. It was me and my mom against my dad and his lawyer and our lawyer, and my dad tried to nullify my contract, but he couldn't because my mom's my legal guardian. And so they invoked the Jackie Coogan child prodigy law, which stated that the state of California was trustee over my affairs until I was 21. And I didn't speak to my dad between 18 and 21 because I, you know, that famous line, I'm grown now, I should be able to do what I want, the same thing my daughter told me. And until they realize that, you know, who's paying the insurance and who's paying the education and all this kind of stuff. So anyway, that's when I start watching the stock market because you know, I was a broker later on in life. Mm-hmm. I start watching the stock market and watching my little money, and they put my money in IBM stock and Standard Oil of California at that time, which is Chevron now. And so my money tripled by the time I was 21. And I went and helped my mom in school and brothers and sisters and bought some property in Sacramento. Then all of a sudden my dad, you know, wasn't such a bad guy. And then, you know, we got close again because I was wrong. But, you know, how many times, you know, do your kids come tell you that, you know, that they were wrong? And so from then on, well, not from then on, my dad was always my best friend almost, you know. But there was a time period where I wasn't his.
And he didn't want you to go pro? Was that it?
No, he wanted me to go pro, but not then.
You wanted to go to school first?
Yeah, I mean, my parents were about education, you know, and especially at that time, you know, your oldest son, I'm the oldest of five. And that, if I could, and my dad worked two jobs for 30 years and saved the money and then start buying some income properties, which he was going to give. He was going to sell each income property per child, you know, so that we could go to school. And my dad had three at the time. And so, like I said, my dad was a hardworking man. I mean, he worked. I never saw my dad sick. I never saw my dad complain. I never saw my dad do anything. And the one thing my dad didn't like, he didn't like complainers. Because if you complained, my dad would say, go get me the X-Lax. So, man, it's my wrist hurting. What's that got to do with X-Lax? So the next time I say, man, my knee is killing me, he said, go give me the X-Lax. So I didn't care if I was dying. I didn't complain about anything. I don't complain today. And don't offer me no chocolate unless it has a bunch of peanuts in it. Because people are shocked that I don't eat chocolate, and they just don't understand how my dad traumatized me when I was young.
And your fear of being a failure in your dad's eyes seemed to really motivate you on the field.
Right? Yeah, it did. I didn't want my dad to be right. You know, you know. I mean, yeah. I just, you know, that'd kill me if I hadn't made it. And because then, It's different than now. See, then if you signed as a pro, you were a pro in everything. That was the Jim Thorpe law. Where now, if you're a pro in baseball, you can still go to college and play football or basketball. So then that's why the decision was so major, you know, because that was a lifelong decision. If I didn't make it, then I don't know what I was going to do. And so I'd like to think that I would have, you know, gotten an education, but it was it would probably cost too much.
You had a letter of intent was to go to Santa Clara. Do you think that was the right call?
No, that wasn't my decision either. That was my dad's decision. I didn't want to go to Santa Clara. Uh-huh. Yeah, I wanted to go to Santa Clara. I mean, Coach Williams was a great guy. But, like, you know, Mr. Winterout, this guy I grew up with, he, you know, his dad got Playboy magazine. And, you know, we were looking at the girls and they were looking at the interviews, you know. and so... it said in the interview that Arizona State and San Jose State were the 1-2 party schools in the country, and that you could keep a 2.0 average and stay eligible. I'm like, man, that's for me. That's where I want to go. So that's where I wanted to go. And my dad, he told me, he said, oh, no, boy, you're not going there. He says, that's the 1-2 party school in the country. And my dad's a Baptist deacon, and I was like, well, man, were you over Mr. Winterow's house? I didn't want to ask him where he got his information from.
If you're just joining us, we're talking at the Commonwealth Club with Dusty Baker, former manager of the San Francisco Giants and author of the new book, Kiss the Sky, My Weekend in Monterey for the Greatest Rock Concert Ever. I'm Greg Dalton. You also write that you joined the Marines, and that was good for you.
Yeah, I mean, I joined the Marines around this 19 again. I was, you know, I was kind of confused in a lot of different areas because I was pulled here and there, and I had to join the Marines in the South again because I signed up in Atlanta. So I went to Parris Island, South Carolina. I mean, it was, you know, being a competitor, they said there was going to be one guy here come out and dress blues and everybody else would be in green. So I figured you might as well just get that to me now and save the time. And which I did come out in dress blue. I took pride in being an expert in the pistols and the rifle range and hand-to-hand combat and different things. And, you know, that was good for me because it taught me really, I didn't think so at the time, but it taught me teamwork, I think, better than any time. And I was always usually the captain of most teams I was on, but it taught me not to be judgmental of people because if you're having to cover somebody's back that you really don't like, now that's teamwork. You know what I mean? To have to cover a guy, you know? I mean, next to you that probably wouldn't invite you over to his house and I probably wouldn't invite him over to mine, but that's, and it taught me how to respect another man's space, you know, about hard work and because I was a, you know, like most kids, 18, 19 years old, man, I was like messy. My room was a mess. And then I'd come back from military and I'd get on my brothers and sisters for not having everything in order. And, you know, I'd come back and ask them how to get someplace and ask them what are the coordinates. And they're like, what is wrong with this?
So, yeah, what happened to you?
Yeah, and so, you know, it did help me. And, you know, it helped me as a person I was going to be dealing with things of the future. And it helped me with to respect the chain of command, even though I might not go for it, you know, and realize, hey, this guy, he is the boss, even though I don't like what he's telling me. And then sometimes I'd get in trouble with that, but eventually I'd go back to that training sort of.
Did you ever apply that in the dugout where you're managing these athletes that are making millions and millions of dollars?
Yeah, I mean, I remember the last day of boot camp, Sergeant Goolsby, a big old strong man, he says, anybody here got anything against anybody else? And he says, hey, man, because we can't have you holding something against somebody because most of my platoon went to Vietnam. A lot of them didn't come back. I was one of the 6 reservists in our unit. And he says, and this one kid stood up from New York and he goes, I got something against Private Baker because this guy was always in line. Because what happened then, if he messed up in his platoon, he had to do 100 push-ups. And then his platoon leader had to do 100 push-ups for letting him mess up. And then I had to do 100 push-ups for letting everybody else mess up. So every time somebody was doing 100 push-ups, I was the strongest man in the whole place in the world, and I was doing 100 push-ups. And so this kid said, I want to fight Private Baker. So we went out there and boom, boom, and I was beating him up, and then and then the drill instructor says, I didn't tell you to stop. And so I had to beat him up some more. I didn't want to keep beating this kid up. So now he said, that's enough. And then I saw this kid about 20 years later, I'm at Shea Stadium, and he told me that you know, he made it back from Vietnam, and he thanked me for beating him up. I ain't never heard nobody. You know, he said he was a little punk. And so what had happened, it helped me in baseball that I would tell guys, hey, man, you know, you're not going out on the field without talking about it, or if you got to fight it out, I hope you don't, but you're not going out in that field, and we're supposed to be family, we're supposed to be on the same side when you got something against somebody. So you get it out right now. Don't talk behind anybody's back. I didn't go for lying. I didn't have a bunch of rules, but tell me the truth is one of them. You know, show up to work on time, which is like the military, is the second one. Give me all you got while you're at work, and don't do anything to embarrass yourself, your family, or God, and the organization that you're working for. And so these are kind of things that I was, you know, I was taught in the military and my family also.
You write that music was inspirational, getting you pumped up to play. Also, it was I'll Be There, I think, was it your theme song?
I was a senior in high school. That was if I heard I'll Be There by the Fort Tops, like, I automatically got 3 or 4 hits. And so me and my buddy were sitting in the car, game was about to start. You're like, come on, Dusty, game's about to start. I said, man, I got to hear the song, you know? I'm not saying I'm superstitious or anything, but yeah, that was one of my theme songs. I've always had theme songs. Every team I've been on, we had a theme song, you know, something, you know, like we had in L.A., we had like Bad Mama Jamma, we'd hear that, and then we'd play it, and another time we had like Super Freak by
I think that's something Giants fans can relate to for the Dodgers theme song. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's something that gets you in the mood, you know? And like, I had a walk-up song in AAA, which before walk-up songs, they played Johnny B. Goode, that's my name. And so I don't know what my theme song would be now, so.
Let's go to our lightning round for Dusty Baker. Who is the living musician you'd most like to meet?
The living musician? Mm. Quincy Jones.
Who is the dead musician you would most like to meet?
Can I get two? Sure. Miles and Jimi Hendrix.
Well, you met Jimmy. We heard that.
Yeah, no, I'd love to meet him. Okay, let me go back then. I'd say Miles and Otis Redding. Yeah.
Who is your favorite living sports broadcaster?
Vin Scully.
Yeah. What an institution. Was he 40-something, 50 years?
I grew up, hey man, I grew up listening to Vin Scully.
60 years?
Yeah.
Los Angeles Dodgers sportscaster Vin Scully, 60 years.
I guess, man, I'm 66, so he got to be 60 years. Ooh.
This is yes or no. Barry Bonds should eventually be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Yes.
Different question. Barry Bonds will be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. He needs to double his votes for about 37% from the last.
Not as long as the present writers are there. No.
Juicing should be considered when putting players in the hall. Yes or no?
What's that?
Juicing.
What's that?
Performance enhancing drugs.
Oh, I thought you meant like a juicer and put some carrots in. Kale and stuff in there, you know what I mean?
Toothpicks are a good source of protein, yes or no?
No.
No.
Mine were tea tree oil toothpicks, though.
Tea tree oil, okay.
Yeah, I was trying to stop dipping tobacco and they're also doing some periodontal work for myself.
Yes or no? Youth athletes are specializing too early these days.
Most definitely.
You have personally experienced racial bias in the last year.
Yeah.
As a player.
Yeah, if they don't know who you are, they just treat you. It depends how you dress. I'm just telling you that. A lot of it has to do with how you dress or what you drive. And, you know, they're still profiling big time.
As a player, you don't have Hall of Fame statistics.
No.
As a manager, your numbers are better than Hall of Famers Tom Lasorda, Dick Williams, and Whitey Herzog. That and your 39 years as a player and manager will get you into the Hall when you are eligible in 2018.
Probably not, but I think I should be.
I think your chances are pretty good. Solar power is cool.
Well, sure is. I love, I'm in the solar business. Actually, I was drinking one night with my buddies and I was kidding everybody. James Brown came on and I said, hey man, if James Brown, because I have a solar company called Baker Energy Team, figure if you didn't want me on your team, I start my own team. So it's called Baker Energy Team. And they had some t-shirts made. I said, man, James Brown, soul brother number one. I said, I'm gonna be the solar brother. So they had some t-shirts made. So they had some t-shirts made. They got the solar brother on the back of them. I got some crazy partners, believe me.
That looks like a pretty good lingo. Major League Sports should do more to encourage fans to use clean energy and be green consumers.
Definitely. I mean, we're way ahead. There are some states that are way behind. Like Maryland, I think, is ahead in the East, North Carolina. But basically, we are the front runner to most things. You know.
Yes or no, you would like to attend a Taylor Swift concert?
Probably not.
Last question in this lightning round for Dusty Baker. What is your favorite music for getting into a romantic mood?
Well, it used to be like Teddy Pendergrass. Al Green. Yeah, now my wife, she likes the Whispers.
All right, that ends our lightning round for Dusty Baker. How do you do? I think you did pretty well. We put some questions out, a call out on Facebook for some questions, and Mark Kahn asked on Facebook for you to talk about your mentor, Hank Aaron. Mm-hmm. You talked about how your mother met him. Your mother asked Hank Aaron to look after you. During the chase, when he was going after Babe Ruth's records, he received all sorts of death threats, and he saved the letters. And one letter he told USA Today a couple years ago wrote, quote, "Whites are far more superior than jungle bunnies," end quote. So tell us what it was like to be with Hank Aaron as he was going through that chase, and you were on deck when he did.
Well, it wasn't a very pleasant time. I mean, he had to have two rooms. You know, one is a dummy room, and he always had to have a bodyguard with him. Calvin Wardlow, he got to be one of the fellas, and, you know, it wasn't very pleasant. And, you know, he was glad that, you know, when it was over, like I said, he didn't really let us read these letters, but I'd see him throw them on the floor, and I was right next to him, and he'd leave, and I'd read them. But that also prepared me for my life, because I've gotten, in the last, a couple of years, when I was in Cincinnati and Chicago, I got a number of hate mail and racial mail, but it prepared me. Being with Hank then for what was gonna eventually come in my life too. But Hank is a strong man. The thing about Hank is people like Hank's angry, is this and that bitter. No, he's not. I mean, not at all. I mean, this guy he could be, but this guy is a God-fearing man. He's a kind-hearted man. And he reminds me of my dad, you know, where he would not be judgmental, but he would treat people the way that, you know, he would like to be treated.
Seems to be. He's a great, gracious ambassador for baseball.
Oh, yeah, big time. But you're talking about mentors. I know there's also a subject. You know, I had two mentors in my coaching career. Namely, like I said, my dad was my coach and Bobby Bonds coach coming up. But the two I was most fortunate to have in my life was Bill Walsh and Al Attles. And whenever I was having trouble in the beginning of coaching, of a player that didn't want to listen or didn't want to respond, I know I could call Bill and Al Attles and they'd give me the right answer. And the right answer sometimes is not the answer that I wanted, but it was the answer that they gave me and ended up being the right answer.
Interesting. Didn't know that about Bill Walsh. So in 2014, Hank Aaron said that progress has been made in this country on race. We have an African-American president. Still a long way to go. Yeah. And he so said, quote, "Back then, the racists, they had hoods. Now they have neckties and starched shirts." So how far do you think we've come as a country and as the sport come?
Well, it looked like it's going backwards to me, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, on the field and in management at the same time. But it just seems like that's the way kind of the world, when the money gets bigger, when the money gets larger, people tend to share less, you know, and this is what I see. And, but I can't really blame a lot of those in charge, because Bob Marley says, don't blame the children. He says, you got to blame the adults. And so some of these people that are in charge now, they heard their parents, some of us say, hey, take care of number one, look out for yourself. Well, that's what they're doing. And it seems like, you know, the lines of separation between the haves and the have-nots have become wider and wider and wider. And I'm sort of fearful that, you know, at some point in time, we may have some serious trouble brewing here that people are going to be surprised, but they shouldn't be surprised. So, to me, we got to get our, you know, ourselves together and just try to share a little better than we're doing.
Is sports a way people can do that? I mean, it's sort of the spirit of the Olympics, you know, on the playing field.
Well, you know, I'm telling you, there were, because my teams that I signed with the Braves, most of them were in the South, and most of the players that were drafted were from the South, and. You know, I think sports has changed a lot of people's minds on because I remember, you know, one of my coaches now, he said he never saw a black person in his life. He's from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. He never saw a black person in his life until he saw his roommate, and which showed progress, because back in the day, you couldn't have a white roommate, because if you had the only way you got your own single room, if there was a odd number of blacks and whites, they wouldn't put the black and white players, you know, together. And and this guy told me he didn't sleep all night, because all he had seen was in Detroit the riots, you know, and he slipped that one eye open. And then he said, hey, man, I mean, now this guy's one of my best friends, one of my coaches. Dick Pohl was my coach. This is the guy I'm talking about. And I mean, this guy, you know, realized that, you know, the only way for us to get to know each other is to spend time around each other. And this is like one of my things that I used to do. I used to have guys play different music on different days, guys bring in the different food groups, because that would break down a lot of the racial barriers. Because, I mean, there are people who might not like Asians, but they're eating Chinese food, or they may not like Jewish people, they're going to eat some bagels, or, you know, they may not like Mexicans, but everybody eats Mexican food. So it's like, hey, you bring in your food, play their music. And then after a while, you know, I see some guys from Mississippi doing salsa, and some other guys, you know, over here, you know, playing or singing a country western song that, you know, couldn't stay. That happened to me, because there was a one guy on our team, in A-ball. He had he used to play. He's from Hayes, Kansas. He said he liked soul music, and he liked Charlie Pride. That's his version of soul music. And so the song was "The Snakes Crawl at Night." Anybody ever heard that song? Oh, man. And then I hated that song. And then I found myself singing that song.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dusty Baker about music and his life in sports. I'm Greg Dalton. You mentioned briefly that baseball is going backwards in terms of managers, African-American managers, and Bill Gould asked on Facebook for you to comment on that, because I think there's been 14 African-American managers since Frank Robinson broke through. There were 8 in the league in 2002, and it's gone backwards since. Magic Johnson's now an owner of the Dodgers. What do you make of baseball?
Well, but there's none now. You know, if that's not going backwards, I don't know how much more backwards can you go. And it's just... seems like, you know, friends are hiring friends, and if you don't have a friend up there, then your chance of getting hired are slim. And, I mean, the record of African Americans, you know, I was always told you had to be twice as good to accomplish the same thing by my mom when I was a kid. And so, you know, you have to be twice as tolerant because there's people that aren't used to ever having African-American as a head coach, as a principal, or a boss. I mean, you know, we've had to know how to get along with other people more than most people have had to learn to get along with us. But I was very fortunate where I've been in all societies. I played winter ball in Puerto Rico, Mexico, Venezuela. Then went to all-white high school. Then I went straight to the South with segregation in the South. And so I've had to learn how to, you know, get along with everybody. And my dad used to always tell us, man, you judge a person on how he treats you. And my best friend that I went to high school with, the guys I went to concerts with, he's still my best friend since we were 15. I met him the first day of school. And I said, I saw him checking me out. I said, hey, man, you looking for trouble? At the end of the day, he goes, no, man, I like your style. I said, man, I was so happy to hear that. I took my hand out. You know, I'm looking for a friend. And so, you know, during the, when I left to go play ball, he would call me. I'd write him, boom, boom, boom. And then I quit calling him and quit writing him and quit answering his anything because he was, I said, if there's a revolution, which there was about to be, you know, people wouldn't understand that this guy's a good dude, or they wouldn't understand that I'm a good dude if I was on the other side. So I quit writing or anything, and all of a sudden I'm in West Palm Beach, and I felt a guy watching me, and I looked over, and it was him, and he had driven from Sacramento, California to West Palm Beach, Florida, to find out why I wouldn't answer his calls anymore. And so that sort of just broke me down. It's like, man, a shooter. Man, this is a friend right here. I don't care what color he is, you know what I mean? So, I mean, he's my partner then and my best partner now.
You were in the running recently to be managers of the Washington Nationals. It came down to two people, mm-hmm. Bud Black and you. It looks like it's not going your way.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on that?
Well, maybe, I mean, whatever I really wanted to do in my life most of the time, it didn't work out anyway. Now, you know, what God wanted me to do and what he, you know, sent me the direction always worked out. See, I really didn't even want to coach. You know, I didn't want to play baseball, but it worked out. I didn't really want to coach. And Al Rosen's the one that asked me to, hey, come join us. And so I went to Arrowhead, me and my brother. I was getting divorced again. Not again, but the first time, well, my first divorce, but I had been a victim of divorce in my parents. So I was like, man, is this deja vu all over again? And so I was up there, and I'm checking in the line, and Bob Lurie taps me on the shoulder, and he says, you need to come join us. And I had gone up there to pray, to ask for a direction, and before I even checked in the hotel, the direction was standing right behind me. And so I called my dad, and I said, Dad, what do you think? You think that's a sign? And he says, boy, you went up there to look for a sign and asked for a sign, and you don't want to see it. It's standing right behind you even before you checked in. So that's what started my coaching career. And when things don't work out like this, it wasn't supposed to work out anyway. The way I look at it, God got something better planned for me. I wish he kind of let me know pretty soon.
And what was it about the Nationals? Was it control? Was it the money? Have they notified you yourself, or it's been in the press?
Well, no. I mean, they haven't notified me. You know, the way baseball does, I mean, sometimes people, you know, they don't call people back. I mean, and when people call me, I feel an obligation to call them back. I mean, that's how I was raised. And people thank me for calling them back. I said, you don't have to thank me for calling you back. I mean, you know, that's the right thing to do. And like my dad always taught me, you know, when in doubt, just, you know, do the right thing. At least your version of the right thing. It may not be right in the eyes of the people, but at least it's your version of doing the right thing.
You write in your book, Dusty Baker, about your children, Darren and Natasha, and how you've shared your music with them. They've shared their music with you. I think you shared Snoop Dogg, and your daughter shared New Kids on the Block. So tell us about.
Well, yeah, I mean, my daughter, if she was, I got a hip daughter, and she's 36. She's 20 years older than my son. And he's 16, and so I took her to concerts. And see, when her mom and I broke up, she was 8, and so my summer visitation, you know, and I was coaching then, she was my roommate. And I took her every town we went in, We went to the Statue of Liberty. We went up to the Arch. That was the worst one. And don't worry about me going up there again. And so, anyway, like, you know, I'd take her to concerts. And, you know, then she started taking my son. You know, she took him to see Lil Wayne, but I took him to see, like, Snoop Dogg. I took him to see 50 Cent. And, you know, like, I'm trying to get into some of, you know, his music. You know, the way my mom didn't want to get in any of my music. And in order to keep me hip and understanding, you know, where the young kids on my team are coming from. And, you know, it's really helped me, you know, a lot. You know, he's a music man. And, music makes the world go around to me. I mean, this is why I listen to music first thing in the morning when I get up, whatever mood I want to get in. If I'm in a hurry, I listen to different music. If I'm, I got this Subaru, that's my Rastamobile, that I only listen to Rasta music, but I got this for Hawaii, because it's a mountain car. And then all my brothers get on me, they say I'm the only brother in America with a Subaru. but I don't care, man, let them talk.
Could do a commercial, maybe there'll be more.
Yeah, you gotta change the demographics of everything, right?
There you go. Dusty Baker, you're involved with an organization, have been, Positive Coaching Alliance. Mm-hmm. Bill Walsh, who you said was a mentor to you,
yeah.
It teaches learning life lessons through youth sports. Tell us mm-hmm. about what PCA, the Positive Coaching Alliance, is trying to do for young kids to kind of teach them lessons through sports.
Well, I mean, I think PCA is not only, you know, for the young kids, it's also for the adults. It teaches them how to coach positively, because since I've been around now at home and going to my son's games, I see the need, you know, for positive coaching, because it's becoming difficult for me to be around the parents to listen to. To listen to some of the stuff that I have to hear.
Parents, you know, are pretty intense these days.
Well, yeah, and I was at one of my son's games, and the kid struck out with the bases. No, he popped up, the bases loaded, and the dad goes, "You stink," like this. And he's standing right here. I said, "Hey, man, don't say that." And he goes, "Well, he didn't hear me." I said, "I heard you." Yeah, you know what I mean? I mean, it's so, like, and your friend and your son can feel you. You know what I mean? He can feel disappointment. And so it just teaches you how to, you know, deal with the failures. It teaches you how to coach positively without giving a trophy. I don't believe in giving a trophy away to everybody that doesn't deserve it, too. You know what I mean? So. There are no perfect formulas, but I think Positive Coaching Alliance is on the way.
And electronic devices, I know you have a 16-year-old. You probably grew up sandlot, playing ball, didn't have a walk around, you know, with your face in a screen.
Right.
How's that affecting kids playing sports, real sports, being active?
Well, number one, if they'd have had that when we were growing up, we might have been doing it too. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we didn't have anything. All we had was a radio and a TV. But you know, I mean, these kids, I mean, they've grown up, but you have to, I could tell my son, go outside sometime, you know, I mean, leave that in the room, you know, you got to see what's going on in the world, because you'll miss a lot of the world with your head down. There's going to be a lot of neck trouble in the next, in the next 45, 50 years. And I remember one day I took, it was last summer, I think I took my family to Vancouver. And because I like hanging out in Washington and, well, Seattle and Vancouver and up that way in the Northwest. So I told my son, I said, "Hey, man, put that thing down and just look out the window." He goes, "For what? What am I supposed to look out the window?" I said, just look out the window. And then we were going to, there's a highway, the Sea to Sky Highway, that's between Vancouver and Whistler. And he saw an eagle come down and get a fish out of the water. And he goes, "Dang, Dad, man, if I had been looking down, I wouldn't have seen it." And I said, "See, son, just, I'm glad it's, you know, when I'm right sometimes."
Dusty Baker is former manager of the San Francisco Giants and author of the new book, Kiss the Sky, My Weekend in Monterey for the Greatest Rock Concert Ever. I'm Greg Dalton. We'd like to invite your participation by going to the microphone over here. We have about 17 minutes left for your questions for Dusty Baker. Encourage you to join us with one-part question. I'm here to help you if you need some help with that. And we'll get as many in as possible. Please hold the microphone right up and identify yourself, and we'll get through these. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. Let's have our question for Dusty Baker.
Hi, I'm Peter Yedidia. Is this working?
Yes.
I'm one of the two other guys in the room who was at Monterey. I'm just wondering, did you have a favorite moment, a favorite group that you recall there? I would tell you mine, but
yeah.
I don't want to waste time.
That's
okay. I'd sure love to hear yours.
Well, I mean, my favorite groups were naturally Jimi Hendrix and Otis Redding. Yeah, big time.
So many people there at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967.
Yeah.
Let's have our next question for Dusty Baker.
Hey, Dusty, I'm Baseball Mary, but
hey,
you know
Mary,
that already.
I know you, Mary.
Last time I saw you, you said that your wine was not legal yet, but I saw that mm-hmm. you had some during the TBS broadcasting of some of the playoffs.
Right.
So I'm wondering when we can get our hands on that.
Well, we just became legal a couple weeks ago, and we just put our labels on like 2 days ago. Three days ago.
What's the label?
In Paris Island, it's called Baker Family Wines, and we have an auxiliary company as well, B&B Wines, and we bottle and keep our wines at Treasure Island Winery, because in Treasure Island there's a lot of wine going on in Treasure Island. Trust me.
And there's a wine tasting out in Treasure Island, former military base. Not a place you'd think of as a wine location.
Mary, I have some cards, but I have to get them for you outside. Okay. Thank you.
Let's have our next question for Dusty Baker.
Hi, Dusty. Really enjoying your post-game commentary.
Thank
you. And your suits and your outfits. Really awesome. Big fan. I had a complex baseball question. I want to do something else. If you don't want to answer, I totally respect that.
That's all right.
I'm wondering if you you alluded to kind of some racial issues currently and how we're going backwards. I'm wondering if you and your wife have had the talk with Darren, and if so, how did he take it? How did he respond?
That's a good question. Well, I mean, I tell him, you know, when you're talking to your kids, you don't know how they took it. And you don't even know if they're really listening, but then until later. And I just told him, I just said, son, there's still some racism out there. And it's sometimes it's not even racism. Sometimes it's, being my son, there's some coaches that you're going to have that are going to be down on you because they might not have liked me, or they figured that you have everything. And I just try to tell the coaches, don't take anything from it. Don't give him anything. Just don't take him anything from him. And so I just tell him, hey, man, there's going to be, imagine how hard it was being Barry Bonds, the son of Bobby Bonds. Or imagine how hard it was being Ken Griffey Jr., the son of Ken Griffey. So there's certain pressures that come with being my son. But, so far he's handled it pretty good.
Does he have ambitions, athletic ambitions?
Oh, yeah. He's had them since he was a little kid, So, and he's... Yeah, and he's gonna go, and he's gonna go to Cal. He committed to Cal.
So he's getting that education his dad didn't first.
Yeah, well, the education and his scholarship too. So, to play baseball.
Let's have our next.
Hey, Paula.
Hi, Dusty. It's great to have you back in San Francisco.
Thank you.
I had a question about what you said you had learned in the military about having teammates talk things out, grudges. There were a lot of newspaper reports about the bad blood between Jeff Kent and Barry Bonds. Could you ever get them to talk of that out?
Yeah,
if it was there, maybe it wasn't.
No, but it's going to happen. I mean, when you got two bulls in the ring, it's going to happen. And, they're closer now. You know what happens when you get through playing and there's no competition? Guys get closer afterwards, because they realize what they've done and what they've accomplished. I did tell them both of them, I told them, hey, man, you guys are just alike. You got one black, one white, one Baptist, one Mormon. And I said, look, you guys remind me, I told them to go look at that movie with Tony Curtis and Sidney Poitier when they were like handcuffed together. And then Tony Curtis tried to throw Sidney Poitier off the cliff, and he realized he was going down the cliff too. Honestly, that's what I told him. You guys need to watch that movie.
Just to let you know, I had signed up for this thing completely before I ever realized you were going to be talking about music.
Oh, great.
But just to let you know, I have an old car with a satellite radio in it, and I think it's stuck on 60s on 6.
That's cool.
But the question I had for you, with all the money in baseball, I mean, all sports right now, do you think it's really spoiling it for everyone, really?
Well, it's not spoiling for those that are sharing in the revenue. You know, I mean, it is a business, and this... Have you ever had a boss that paid you more than he paid himself? You know, unless you're in sales, there's a great chance that whatever they're paying this guy or whoever he is, LeBron or Barry or whoever, that the people, the smart business people upstairs have figured out how much money they can make, and they're going to make more money. You know what I mean? Because, see, bosses tend to take care of themselves, you know? And so there's a lot of money in baseball. I mean, I understand that. But I mean, but you got to think about who's going to share the money. Okay, so why should ownership make all the money? I mean, shouldn't they share some of it with the players too? Because see, I know in my household, I have a football package, basketball package, baseball package. I probably spend about $1,000 a year on packages. Well, and I was trying to figure out how many people in here are doing the same kind of packages. And see, that's where the money is. Money's not in ticket sales. Money's in TV. So, like, again, you know, I'm into sharing. But I don't mind you getting yours, too, but we just got to share.
Let's have our next question for Dusty Baker at the Commonwealth Club.
Right. Hey there, Devil Dog, former Marine here as well,
hey,
man.
Hey.
Hoorah.
Hoorah.
What I wanted to ask you is that there's a lot of things, man. I've seen you in interviews and everything and never really got a chance to listen to you speak, man. You speak very eloquently and it's very nice to be here, man. You were talking about how your old school attitude maybe, and my question to you is, do you think that maybe old school attitude, meaning, I believe it, are going by the wayside, fundamentals, mm-hmm. Stuff that we learned in boot camp, treating
right.
people correct. There is no different colors, or everyone's green, dark green, light green, that sort of thing.
Right.
Do you think maybe that might be a detriment to maybe managers such as yourself and ones that are still out there looking for employment, getting
Probably.
Employment in today's baseball?
Probably. But that's a great question. But see, I believe that, you know, you should maintain old morals and ideas, but present them in a modern way. You know what I mean? Because who says that before was wrong? But also at the same time, I feel that you should be able to combine the two. You know what I mean? I like being around young people because they crack me up and they give me laughter, they give me energy. But I'm hoping that I can give them some knowledge and some wisdom, you know, in my age. So why does one have to go by the wayside and why does one have to occupy all the space? I think that, you know, basically America's losing respect for the elderly. I mean, you can tell there's age discrimination now more than there is race discrimination, if you want to know the truth. Because you know something? You're going to be old someday too. You know what I mean? And but I like your attitude. Keep that attitude.
Excellent. Thank
you. All right, man.
Let's have our next question.
Good to see you. We missed you in the Bay Area. Good to
Thank
see you back.
Man.
A couple things. One, if you could talk about money, and obviously this has been a big issue, the Dodgers spending, what is it, $300 million, which gets into the playoffs but not to the World Series or the end. Is there an end in sight for this profligate spending, which just goes up and up and up every year, L.A., New York, even San Francisco's, you know, increasing its payroll? Is there any end in sight to this astronomical payroll?
Probably yeah. not, because you know something they told us that that if we didn't end free agency 20 years ago, baseball is going to go broke, but I see people standing in line to buy teams. You know what I mean? So I don't know where it's going to stop. I really don't have any clue.
Can baseball continue as it is, being the sport it is, without being such a business, though, with all that money? Can it maintain
Probably
integrity?
Not. You know, the more business, you know, the more money, the more need for, you know, for baseball to be a business. You know, so I don't see it stop being a business.
Finally, Dusty, we loved you here in the Bay Area as a Giant manager. Were there any couple memories or thoughts or moments that were really special for you? I'm sure there were many, many, but can you tell us about one or two?
Well, yeah, I had a couple with being on deck with Hank Aaron, you know, when he broke the record big time. I was the manager of Barry Bonds when he broke the record. I was with King Griffey Jr. when he hit 600. I mean, I've been, you know, some big time moments in history and time that I didn't realize now until I got time to sit back and look.
So what's it like for you to go in there and tell a player that he's been traded? You talk about it's family, but it's a business, and they know it and you know it, but take us to a moment where you got to go in and tell somebody, he's like, sorry, you know, you're beaten. You're
well, I've had people cry. I've had people ask why. You know, the one that was a good trade for us, a couple when I was with the Giants, one was Matt Williams for Jeff Kent. I mean, Matty was like my son, and Jeff ended up like being my son, but you stay close to the ones that you're close to. And then the one that I like to trade with Ellis Burks for Darrell Hamilton, but Darrell Hamilton, God bless his soul, that hurt him to his heart. And because it hurts, you know, to get traded. You go through a period of, like you're unwanted or you're not good enough, unless you demanded the trade. Now, if you demanded the trade,
that's different. Yeah.
That's different. Now you're like, hey, I'm ready to get out of here, man. Let's go somewhere. But it's tough. And then you have to think about the families. Like you've seen a guy go from the wife go from girlfriend to wife to kids, and then sometime even divorce, and then another wife. You know what I mean? So, I mean, you grow up with these guys.
Yes. Let's have our question for Dusty Baker.
I'm probably the only Dodger fan in here.
No, you're not.
Okay. However, growing up in South Central and remembering you playing there, you mentioned Vin Scully, which I'm glad you did. Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite Vin Scully story that you may have had a chat with him or heard him tell us?
Well, he used to call me Johnny Lee, and my name's Johnny B, and I every time I tell him. Yeah, but every time I tell him my name's Johnny B, he'd say Johnny Lee. And so, my brother used to emulate Vince Scully, and it was always like, here comes Baker to the bat, bases loaded, two outs, and here's the pitch, and then my brother would go, and I'd say like, and they'd say, this is a long drive, a deep left field. You can tell it goodbye. And then he'd say, listen to the crowd. That's what he do. He say, listen to the crowd. So, these are games we played as a kid.
We've been talking about baseball as big business. You have a son who sounds like he's aspirations. What advice do you have to him or others who have their eyes on the big leagues, which is changing? It's more of a money game these days.
Well, there's always going to be need for good players. I mean, just because there's a lot of players making money that are probably making money past their ability because a lot of the game is diluted somewhat, and but I tell him, hey, you got to work hard. You got to work hard. You have to be smarter than the next guy, because as you elevate yourself up in the game, there's not that much ability between this guy and that guy, but it's the guy that's willing to willing to be taught, the coachable guy that I could tell something to, and then he'll pick it up or through muscle memory and whatever, he can respond upon command. It's a guy that thinks the quickest on his feet is a guy that's going to get the lead. And like I tell my son, he has a lead already by being my son. I said, just keep the lead. Don't worry about everybody else or try to fit in with everybody else, because that's what I went through in my life. I never really fit in, And then I'd realize that, hey, man, well, maybe I'm different, and it's okay to be different. And, don't worry about fitting in. And if you got the lead in life, you figure out how to keep the lead.
Well, Dusty Baker, we're about to the end of our time here talking about your life in sports and your love for music. I want to end with Otis Redding, and you set it up for us. Tell us what Otis Redding means to you, then we're going to play a little clip of Otis Redding at the Pop Festival in 67.
Otis Redding, You know, when he sang, you know, A Little Tenderness, and he sang Sitting by the Dock of the Bay, I could really, really identify with him.
Some despair in there.
Yeah, I mean, I was sitting on the dock over there yesterday in Corte Madera, and you know, by myself, and just thinking, and I was thinking about Otis Redding. I went to see a friend of mine in jail in Lompoc a few months ago, and it affected me such where I had to go sit by Morro Bay, and I understand what he meant by, you know, sitting on the dock of the bay. And I have a placard at my house that said by Satchel Paige that says, sometime I go to the beach and I thinks, and sometime I go to the beach and I just sit. And I was like, man, that's pretty deep, you know.
Let's hear this clip from Otis Redding at the 1967 Pop Festival in Monterey.
I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. I've had nothing to live for, and look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time.
So Dusty Baker, Otis Redding can say Frisco, but I hope you don't let other people in Chicago and other places, you make sure they say San Francisco,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I know. I don't even mess with them.
We've been talking at the Commonwealth Club with Dusty Baker, former manager of the San Francisco Giants and also the Cincinnati Reds and Chicago Cubs, author of the new book, Kiss the Sky, My Weekend in Monterey for the Greatest Rock Concert Ever. I'm Greg Dalton. I'd like to thank our audience here and online.
I got to say one thing. Listen, I'm not making a penny off of this book.
Yes.
And this book is going to the Wellness Center, which I visited the other day. It was so deep in Santa Cruz. To teach kids how to write novels and how to write, and then 80% is going to them and 20% is going to, you know, bilingual church in Sacramento. So.
I'm Greg Dalton. I'd like to thank Dusty Baker and our audience here and online. And next time, come back, you know, wear a little tie-dye. We're not so stiff around here, all right?
Hey, I got some Hendrix tie-dyes at the
All right, thanks. And you'll be signing books.